passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague Peter Flaherty. Millie is here, just back from an outing, so I think she's asleep. Peter, we've got a lot to talk about. It's been a meaty week around college baseball, both on the field and off the field. For the first time this season, there's a new number one in the top 25 is Wake Forest. Moves up to number one for the first time in program history. We're going to get into that and how the Deacs came to be number one this week. But I think the place we got to start, we got to start with the gambling stuff. That's a sentence that has never before been said on the Baseball America College Podcast. We've been doing this podcast for a long time. Baseball America was actually a very early adopter in the podcasting realm. And I still feel like this is maybe going to be a first as we get into some gambling stuff, Peter. Alabama last week fired coach Brad Bohannon. It's been almost a full week now as you guys listen to this podcast on Thursday. We recorded last week on Wednesday. He was fired on Thursday amid an investigation into some gambling issues as they relate to Alabama's game against LSU a couple weeks ago, the series opener. A lot of reporting been done on that from ESPN to get to, you know, some details from that. But the bottom line is that Brad Bohannon was fired. And then this week we got news out of Iowa that Iowa and Iowa State both have been, you know, apprised of investigations in their state from their state racing and gambling authority, and they have suspended a whole bunch of athletes across a variety of sports. Obviously, for our purposes, Iowa State doesn't really matter a whole lot since they don't have baseball, but this has included a few Iowa baseball players. You know, Iowa hasn't named anyone. Where that investigation is going to go remains unseen or unknown at this point. We know very, very few details there. The Iowa AD, Gary Barta, I just saw, told The Athletic's Scott Docterman today that they did not know when they might expect the suspended players would be cleared. So a lot going on. Obviously, Alabama and Iowa both project as NCAA tournament teams. We'll get into Alabama a lot more later on in terms of their hopes and everything. But Peter, it's just been a really strange week overall.
Yeah, very strange indeed. Obviously difficult to see with Coach Bohannon and how it went down. You know, we could talk at length about it, but with obviously no players being involved and that being your head coach, it really rubbed me the wrong way for a lot of reasons, just with how hard your student athletes work day in and day out, the common goal that you all seem to share in winning these ball games, and obviously with these guys' future at stake. And it was really upsetting to see how it all shake down. I remember when it kind of first came out, you and I were in, I guess, somewhat of the camp of, okay, that this was just a very weird thing in Ohio. Sports gambling nowadays has become so widespread and almost normal that just based on the sheer odds of things, there was going to be one weird bet that kind of raised some eyebrows. And then it went back to, okay, this was just nothing other than just a random person feeling really confident about Paul Skeens. But it turned out it was way worse than that. A tough week for Alabama, but they responded in about, I think, the best way that they possibly could have, with a really impressive series win. So again, tough, but I'm glad that, you know, they resolved it quick. They resolved it swiftly. And then they responded the way that they did, and they're ready to hopefully finish out the season pretty strong.
Yeah, I mean, the deal there is much more impactful, I guess, than the one in Iowa. And we should say that there has been no evidence that's been presented. And in fact, the Iowa Gaming and Racing Commission, or Racing and Gaming Commission, actually, has said that, like, they have not taken Iowa baseball games off of their books. Like, there's no indication that there's, like, any sort of, like, real foul play within that. And because it's so wide ranging, it almost seems more likely that this was just a variety of student athletes that gambled, which is, I believe, against state law, certainly against NCAA policy or Iowa policy. And the situations, they happened within, you know, the news broke within a week of each other, but they're not the same. So that is important to know, but we'll just have to see where that goes. Iowa is a little bubbly, as they so often are, but they're trying to make their first NCAA tournament since 2017 and get their first at-large bid in much longer than that. So something to watch for sure. I guess, Peter, let's just get into the Alabama Vanderbilt situation here a little bit more. You alluded to them winning a big series there, and the crazy part was that series started on Thursday. It was a Thursday to Saturday SEC series. Brad Bohannon is announced to be fired at, I want to say, like, about 9 o'clock local time for Alabama, and they had to play a game that night against a top five Vanderbilt team. And they went out there, they won that game resoundingly. And then they lost on Friday. They come back, they win 2-1 on Saturday in the finale. Just a phenomenal pitching effort all weekend from Alabama. And just kind of a reminder that Alabama's a good team. I felt like last weekend could have gone one of two ways for them, that either, you know, the distraction, the noise, the turmoil, all of that was just going to be too much and they fold, or they use it to galvanize and, you know, they're a good team. This is a team that started the season incredibly well in non-conference and has played well throughout the year. Really, that, you know, they're up and down like a lot of SEC teams, but they've been a solid team much of the season, and they come away with just like you said, as good of a response as you could ask for.
And the first game, it started out, and I have to admit, in sitting there and turning on ESPNU, this was the most, I think, intrigued for a number of reasons I was to tune in to a college baseball game in some time, just because this was such a unique and almost one-of-one situation. I had no idea how it was going to go for Alabama. And combine everything that happened off the field with the fact that they're facing a Vanderbilt team that had been playing some of the best baseball of anyone in the country for the better part of a month and a half, 2 months. I was really, really interested to see how the tie would do and to make. And RJ Schreck got the scoring started, third hitter of the game, hit a home run down the line, and I was like, oh, here we go. And Luke Holman got out of the inning, and then Bama just exploded from there, and Luke Holman was excellent. And they went on to drop that second game on Friday, which set up for a really intriguing rubber game. And as you mentioned, it was just a pitcher's duel all the way through. Dominic Tomez broke the tie in the eighth inning with a solo home run. And to take everything off the field out of it, one, an incredible series win for Alabama for their tournament aspirations. Two, it was great to see that they were able to flush all of the stuff that had happened, not let it bog them down on the field. It was clear that it also lit a spark under them. And they were really close together as a team, just with how they're playing, how they support each other. And their RPI is now up to 15 after a nice midweek win last night over Troy. And they still have some work to do in terms of notching a few SEC wins down the stretch and not going Ofer and Hoover. But at A&M and versus Ole Miss, I think that, you know, for them to get to that 15 win threshold in the SEC that we so often reference, it's right there for them for the taking. And their RPI is very strong. And if they can just get that, they should be able to eke their way into a regional, which it's a good team. If you take everything else, you know, if you put it aside, they're a really strong club. They can hit well. We saw this weekend how good their pitching can be when it's on. And I think that the Crimson Tide they've built some serious momentum and are playing with a big time chip on their shoulder as we head down the home stretch.
Yeah, I mean, and with their RPI being where it is, they don't even need to get to 15 SEC wins. I think if they just even split, like they don't get swept, maybe even like that, if they're at 13, like that's kind of courting trouble because of how many SEC bubble teams there are. And maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. But if they just split these final two weekends, go 3-3, they're in. And it's going to be interesting to see how it all goes from here. You know, it's one thing to react in the moment. It's another thing to, you know, sustain that as, you know, some of the, you know, we just get into the crunch time of the season, and, you know, you have interim coaching staff trying to do things in a different way and all the rest of that. But Alabama certainly in a strong position coming out of the weekend. Okay. If it weren't for all of the off-field stuff, the biggest story this week would have been Wake Forest moving to number one in the top 25. LSU had been number one throughout the season, starting with the preseason top 25. They have been incredibly consistent. Their run at the top of the rankings was one of the longest for a preseason number one in the 43-year history of the Baseball America Top 25. There were just a handful of teams that did it longer, I guess four teams: 2013 UNC, 1998 Stanford, 1988 Oklahoma State, and 1984 Arizona State. Although notably that back in 1984, our rankings were not weekly. They were biweekly because they just went in the magazine. So it was just a little bit different, but we can still count Arizona State. They were number one from the preseason through the final regular season rankings. So LSU in some pretty rarefied air there, and I know there's been some noise in Baton Rouge about, you know, is there enough pitching? You know, this problem, that problem, the other problem. That's all well and good. Their record is still remarkable, and the consistency that they showed is incredibly rare. So, you know, I understand the concerns, and, you know, down there it's national championship or bust. And like, I get all of that, but also I think what they've done should be celebrated. Now that said, Wake Forest has been incredibly consistent as well this season. They are in first place in the ACC, clearly like they have a comfortable margin. We're just counting down until they clinch the ACC title. They have not lost a weekend series all year, and this last weekend they picked up another nice series win against Boston College. Wake Forest leads the nation in wins. They're the first team to get to 40 wins this year. They have the best winning percentage in the country. They're number two in RPI behind only Kentucky. They lead the nation in ERA. Just a lot of really impressive things about what Wake Forest has been able to accomplish, and now they are number one.
And BC, to their credit, they gave Wake about as tough a series as we've seen a team give the Deacs all year, especially in Winston-Salem. On Friday, Rhett Lauder set the tone with his classic Rhett Lauder outing. 7 shutout with 9 strikeouts. Just really good command of his arsenal, really good feel for it against a BC lineup that And the thing with BC coming into this, as a quick aside, is they were without and will be without their two of their top offensive players in Travis Honeyman and Cam Leary. And that's also 2/3 of their outfield. So coming into the series, it was already going to be an uphill battle for the Eagles, but taking two of those pieces out of a lineup that really needs the production it made that hill just so much steeper. And on Friday night, we caught a whiff of that against Rhett Lauder. Now, BC did have moments where they threatened. They just couldn't get that one hit that, you know, they could seemingly get in all of these other games all year. And then on Saturday was an unbelievable game. We saw BC go out to a quick lead and then Wake Forest get out to a lead in later innings, but BC respond. It was a complete back and forth affair. And it culminated with a Peter Burns game-tying home run in the ninth off of reliever Michael Massey, who has been excellent, just like every other Wake Forest pitcher this year. Burns got a low and in slider below his hands, and he just dropped the head, and he stuck it over the fence. The wind was blowing out all day, so this was a classic game at the couch where any fly ball you saw off the bat, it was probably going to wind up over the fence. And no one could score an extra innings until the 12th. BC finally broke through with a home run from Joe Vetrano, who really carried the load for them offensively this weekend. I think he had 3 home runs. Saw the ball really well, hit the ball hard consistently, and then freshman Kyle Wolf, with the biggest hit of his career so far, added some insurance. So while Wake did end up taking the rubber game with, again, a stellar pitching performance from Josh Hartle, it wasn't easy. In the ninth, BC had the bases loaded and 2 outs. Merrick Houston got a ground ball at shortstop. It was hard hit by Burns, and it was a race to cover the bag between Justin Johnson and Barry Walsh. He was called out on the field. Walsh was, but it wasn't without some intrigue, because on that play, the runner from second didn't stop running for BC, which was the game-tying run, and he had come across to score. So there was a review to end the game, and if the call on the field got overturned, it was going to be that A, Barry Walsh was safe, and B, Boston College scored 2 runs to tie the game. So that was literally as much as Wake could handle, but as they've shown time and time again how great they are as a team, they were able to come away with another ranked series win, and they were able to overtake an LSU team who kind of got their butts handed to him against Auburn.
Yeah, it was definitely a tough one for BC, and just kind of representative of how tough they've played all season long. A lot has not come easy for Boston College this season, but they've just kept hanging in there, and that was a really important win that they were able to get in Winston-Salem. I know they didn't come away with the series ultimately, but just to pick up that one win was important to their chances. As for Wake Forest, this is the first time in program history that they've been number one. Now, they do have a national championship back in 1955. As long as we've been in existence as a publication and ranking college baseball teams, we aren't quite that old. So they did not have the opportunity. They would have been number one then. But in the 43-year history of the rankings, this is their first time at number one. And perhaps more, certainly for me, more intriguingly, this is the latest in a season that a team from the ACC has been number one since 2015, when Virginia won the national championship and therefore was number one in the final poll. But no ACC team since then has been number one in May or June until now. And the ACC in general just hasn't, you know, we think of this conference typically as the second best league in the country because they typically put in either the most or the second most teams in the NCAA tournament. They're right up there in terms of hosts, usually number two in terms of hosts, and they have not had high level, you know, national championship contenders all that often. It feels like nobody's played for the national championship since Virginia did it in back-to-back years from the ACC. They've only spent, I think it's 6 weeks at number one total as a conference. since Virginia won the national title. And I don't want to like turn this into what's wrong with the ACC. Like, this is Wake's moment, and I don't expect Wake to resolve like why hasn't the ACC had more success in Omaha. However, I do find all of that to be interesting, and I do think that it's notable that, you know, Wake Forest has been able to rise above the pack this year. There certainly is an element within the ACC of just beating up on each other. Wake Forest is you know, clearly at the top of the standings. And then there are a whole bunch of teams in there that are tightly packed in the middle. And, you know, Duke and Clemson have been really hot as of late, but the conference overall certainly has an aspect of, unless you're playing Wake this year, like almost anyone can beat anyone on any given weekend. And some of that depends on, okay, when did you play them? Because Virginia started the year really hot. And like I said, now Clemson and Duke are really hot, but it's just been an interesting year for that conference. And it's kind of crazy that Wake Forest is the team that's breaking through in this way. You know, just when you think about it historically, you think about Florida State and Clemson and UNC, and yet here it is, Wake Forest, that has emerged as one of the conference's best national championship contenders in a decade, really.
And that's such an interesting stat you mentioned about the ACC, because admittedly, I had just kind of assumed that, and wrongfully so, that the number of ACC teams in contention for a title was higher than just Virginia in 2019 and UVA in 2015. And because they've had great teams in the past few years, obviously Louisville last year, Notre Dame makes it to Omaha last year. Wake was even solid last year, but they had an early exit. And then Virginia Tech they made a super and they kind of got upset at home by a really hot Oklahoma team. And then you can even rewind a little bit further and talk about the great teams they've had. But with this year, it really feels like if there's any year where a non-UVA ACC team can break through, it's this one. And Wake has built a really impressive 4.5 game lead atop the Atlantic standings, and they have the best record in the conference and the most wins in the conference by a really wide margin, which, again, to your point, is really, really impressive with, I think, the talent top to bottom in the ACC this year. I mean, you look at teams like, really other than, shockingly, Florida State, and even Pitt is floating around 500. Other than those two teams, which are bringing up the rear in their respective divisions, the Atlantic and the Coastal, every team in the ACC is a quality ball club. Like, there is no easy weekend out there. And for them to have sustained this run up to this point, and there's really no reason why they won't be able to for the last couple of weekends of the season, is unbelievable. And if there's any year where a team's going to break through that's not UVA, the clear answer is this one, with how good Wake Forest is. And then you look elsewhere in the conference with how well Duke is playing right now. You can toss that midweek loss last night out, because it's just baseball's weird. And that was kind of a one-off game, but Wake Forest, obviously, with how well they're doing. Clemson, as you mentioned, they're in a really good spot right now to host when they were dead in the water about 4 weeks ago. And then, you know, your other usual suspects, Miami is playing well, UVA, as we've mentioned. But no, the ACC, this is one of the better years that I can remember for the conference as a whole. And it seems like there are a lot of teams in here that are A, going to host, and B, have the ingredients it takes to sustain one of these deep tournament runs.
It'll be interesting to see how things shake out for them, you know, as a conference, and for Wake Forest. You know, right now, in the projections that we just published this week, I moved Wake Forest to the number one overall seed, and you know, they've earned it. And you know, we can talk about whether you want it or not, but they've certainly earned it. And if they get it, you know, just another testament to what they've done as a team, and what Tom Walter and the coaching staff have built over, you know, several years, but also specifically in the last year, and just incredible job again this year by Wake Forest. They've played really well to this point, and No matter how the season ends, it's going to have been, I think, a success for Wake Forest, you know, assuming they go out and they finish this ACC title. But, you know, they can dream bigger right now. They can dream about, you know, going back to Omaha for the first time in decades and you know, maybe adding a second national championship to that team's trophy chest. So intriguing times to come in Winston-Salem, but this week, definitely congratulations to Wake Forest on that number one ranking. We're going to get into, you know, the LSU series loss at Auburn was crazy enough, but it was just the start of the craziness in the SEC. There was a lot of interesting stuff happening out west as well, most notably Stanford sweeping Arizona State to take control of the Pac-12 race, and we've got a big weekend of Big 12 baseball ahead of us. We're going to get to all of that and maybe some more, but definitely all of that. But first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
All right, Peter. Let's break down some of this SEC craziness. We've already mentioned that Alabama went out there and won that series against Vanderbilt. We kind of obliquely mentioned that LSU lost to Auburn. You also had A&M over Florida. That was a big one for the Aggies in terms of their postseason hopes. You got Georgia over Tennessee again, major for the Dogs and their postseason hopes. Kentucky, you know, comes away with a sweep of South Carolina. And, you know, a week ago, there was some, you know, you could definitely hear some people saying, well, I don't know, like Kentucky, you know, they'd been in the hosting discussion. And now you got to wonder, like, are they going to end up on the bubble even? Like, is this going to be about them sneaking into the NCAA tournament, not about them hosting? Well, then they swept South Carolina. And now there's like a very clear path for Kentucky to host again. And So a wild weekend around the SEC. Peter, we can start anywhere you want, because I got to say, all of these series were compelling. I mean, maybe not the Kentucky sweep. Like, South Carolina didn't hold a lead at the end of an inning in, you know, throughout the series. But that was still a big result and a surprising result at that. But most of these series were very compelling. We had a lot of rubber games throughout the conference. So it was a fun weekend of SEC baseball.
Right. It was a wild one, because really outside of the SEC, it was a pretty, I would say, stock weekend around the country. There wasn't anything super noteworthy or of a huge upset for that matter, maybe outside of UNCW over Northeastern, which I wouldn't necessarily call a huge upset, but the SEC provided all of the theatrics one needed this weekend. And I think I'll start with talking about Auburn, because it's the second week in a row now where they've done something that no other team was able to do with, which, you know, last weekend they were the first team to win a series at Founders Park on the road. And this weekend, obviously, they were the first team to win a series over LSU, thus knocking them from their number one ranking. And again, it was, as you said, there were a lot of rubber games. LSU on Friday did what it has done so often, which they received an absolute masterclass from Paul Skeens. And for as how good as Paul's been all season, he set a season high in strikeouts with 15. He cruised through the Auburn lineup, a good one at that. And it was kind of he's as good a tone setter as one you can find in the country, and B, as we've seen in recent memory. And after that performance, it's kind of like, geez, you know, a team is not going to beat LSU twice in a row, no matter how good they are, because of their lineup, you know, what they've got, I guess, on the mound. But Auburn went out and did just that. They come out and win on Saturday. It was a really weird game. It was a long game. It was almost Hoover-esque in that point. From that standpoint, we had a really weird fourth inning where Ty Floyd looked like he was cruising, and then Auburn touched him up thanks to some command issues, and then Auburn explodes for four.
There also was a weird ejection in that inning.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Nobody still knows what happened, it feels like.
It was their direct. I'll get the title wrong, but.
Well, no, but it ended up not being that. It ended up being Josh Jordan.
Yeah, it was so weird, because at first people thought it was their director. It was a video guy who was not on.
Yeah, one of the non-uniform personnel.
Yeah, so it was very weird in that sense. And then Auburn scores three thanks to some command issues, and then it was kind of death by a thousand paper cuts in the sixth. They used a few singles and a sac fly to tang four more. But Auburn looked kind of dead in the water as a team. Even just 2 weeks ago, they'd come off a really tough series loss against Alabama, which at the time we had kind of dubbed as, okay, the winner of this series is going to be on the right side of the bubble, the loser the wrong side. And of course Auburn loses, and we're kind of like, okay, Auburn has some serious work to do if they want to get back in the tournament. Looking at their schedule, it is not a favorable one, and they've done the exact opposite. They've now won three SEC series in a row. They've really picked it up on the mound, which was I'd say a pretty big concern coming into it. And their lineup has proven to be really formidable. Their lineup wasn't the issue at all. It was all about the pitching or lack thereof, and just kind of figuring out who's going to fit best where. And all weekend they got really strong pitching from almost everyone they called upon. Will Cannon, most notably, he's been kind of a stalwart in the back end, and he locked down a key save in the game two on Friday night, and how he pitches and how he pounds the strike zone is impressive. So after the last two weekends, Auburn they're not only firmly in the tournament, they've now cracked our top 25. And in going back to looking at their remaining schedule, it is very favorable for them to rack up a couple of more SEC series wins, strengthen their resume, and head into the tournament on a really high note.
we debated Auburn. They're number 25, and ultimately for me, in the last 2 weeks they've beaten South Carolina on the road and now LSU at home, and I mean those are two of the better series wins that you'll find in the country this season. And so, you know, they're a mildly uninspiring overall record of 27-19-1. They're still under 500 in the SEC at 11-13. But, you know, they've got series wins against Indiana, USC, now again against South Carolina and LSU. And I just found that to be, you know, pretty compelling for that final spot. I mean, there are a lot of really deserving teams right now. There are a few teams outside the top 25 that I wish we had room for. You know, you got Texas, you got Indiana State, you know, Tennessee just fell out of the top 25 to make room for Auburn. Like, any of those teams would look great in there. But to me, just having those two series wins, I mean, nobody's got that basically. And certainly not of these teams at the back end that we're talking about. And Auburn's playing as well as anybody is right now, I feel like. And to me, the one of the biggest things that happened this weekend for Auburn was, again, one of the biggest storylines from last week at South Carolina, it just carried over, and it's their pitching staff, which prior to the last couple of weeks just hasn't been very good this season. They've really missed Joseph Gonzalez, who hasn't pitched since opening weekend, and then, you know, a guy that played for Team USA last year, just a guy that can change a pitching staff. I mean, he's not Paul Skeens, but the impact that Paul Skeens has on LSU's pitching staff, that could be a similar impact that Joseph Gonzalez has on Auburn, and they're missing him. But they've really found something lately. They held LSU to just 11 runs on the weekend. That's LSU's lowest output of the season. This is the best lineup in college baseball, the best offense in college baseball. You know, they scored 3 runs on Friday that matched their season low. And then they were held to 2 runs on Sunday, which is a new season low. So a lot of respect for what Auburn's been able to do on the mound this weekend. They did a good job against South Carolina, and they did a great job against LSU. And like you said, the remaining schedule is favorable. I feel really good about where Auburn's at. And, you know, Butch Thompson, just another great job. And if they are able to finish strong with these final two series at Ole Miss and Mizzou, I mean, you just feel like they've got a lot of momentum at the perfect time of year. And look, I don't want to put a ceiling on what they can do. I mean, it's going to be an uphill battle no matter where they end up in the tournament process. They're not going to host, it doesn't look like. But this is a team that could make some noise. And I, again, just so much respect for what they've done the last 2 weeks. Peter, I've expressed that I'm not really that concerned about where LSU is at. How concerned are you about where LSU is at? Specifically, there's a lot of, you know, anytime I go on the radio in Baton Rouge or get asked about LSU, there's, well, okay, they've got Paul Skeens, but do they have enough other pitching? So where do you land on that?
So in looking at where they are right now, they're 38-10, 16-7 in the SEC, and the consensus number 2 team in the country with a chance to get back to that number 1 ranking. They have the best hitter in the country in Dylan Cruz. They have the best pitcher in the country in Paul Skeens. And they have the best lineup in the country with, you could name all other 8 hitters in their lineup that gives them that loaded lineup. However, the injuries to the pitching staff and the inconsistencies on the pitching staff are starting to kind of rear its ugly head. And we had already known since over a month ago, really when SEC play started, that LSU was going to have and did have a Sunday starter issue, just figuring out who fit best in that role and how they were going to perform. It's clear that they're still trying to figure that out, and they might really not end up going into the postseason with an established third starter. There will be a lot of candidates that start a potential game 3 and whatnot. We saw it on Sunday with Christian Little was given the ball, and he really struggled to throw strikes. And granted, Little had been great. I wouldn't say great. He's been solid for LSU this year in what he's been asked to do. He's opened up games. He's come out of the bullpen. This was by far his worst outing of the year, just 28 pitches, 9 strikes. Hopefully that is just a little hiccup that he can bounce back from. But then it's like you kind of look elsewhere, and yes, Ty Floyd has been solid. The stat line wasn't all that pretty from his Saturday start. But I think that they have two with Skeens and Ty Floyd, they have two that's a really solid 1-2 punch, I think, even for as inconsistent at times as Floyd's been, that's a really strong 1-2 punch. That's not a concern. I think that where I'm most concerned is in their bullpen and on Sundays or in third games, who their starter is going to be. Because I think those injuries have really mounted up in the bullpen. Some guys aren't performing as well as you would have hoped, namely Thatcher Hurd, who it's been so weird with Thatcher because it's been two steps forward, almost three steps back. It's just kind of right when you think he's got it figured out, it's another rough showing, which, you know, it's something that you really hope that he can get figured out going into the postseason, because what we saw last year at UCLA was the stuff that he showed and how he pitched was of a potential top five overall draft pick in 2024. So he's got it in there. It's just about tapping into it. But I wouldn't say I'm like all that concerned about LSU and pressing alarm bells and saying the season's over, they've got nothing, they've got no depth. If this regional goes to five games, who are they going to throw? They're going to have to throw, you know, a bullpen arm three times to get through a regional. I'm not really in that camp, but I do think that the offense is going to really have to hit on nights that Paul Skeens doesn't pitch. And I'm not talking about they've got to score double-digit runs because it's going to be a slugfest. I'm talking about they're going to need to not score less than, I think, you know, 4 to 6 runs to feel comfortable with a win, because just with the personnel that they have and will have, this is kind of the squad that they're going to be rolling with into the postseason. So the lineup is going to, I think, be the personnel group that carries it to whatever their ceiling is, which is still absolutely a national championship. There is no reason to temper your expectations on the Tigers, but it's clear that they have their vulnerabilities like any other ball club. So I think that this weekend was the was what really kind of got me a little anxious about their bullpen and the problems it may pose. But overall, I'm not ready to change my overall thoughts on the Tigers all that much.
Yeah, I think some of the concerns feel way overblown to me, and in other respects, I certainly understand where they're coming from. I think that Ty Floyd has been good this season. I mean, has he been great? No. But I do feel like it's a little underrated what he's been able to do as a number two starter, because Skeens has been so good, and because there has been such a problem with the third starter that Floyd ends up getting more lumped with the third starter problem than with Skeens. But I think he's a solid number two. I think that Nate Ackenhausen being back is important for the bullpen. Thatcher Hurd has been way better as a reliever than he was as a starter. And maybe that's a situation where, like, maybe that's a solution at the back of the bullpen. And Gavin Guidry has really stepped up since they've started using him more out of the bullpen. The bullpen's definitely been impacted by not having Edwards and Shores and not having Grant Taylor at all this season. Like, that is definitely, like, you are feeling the effects of that if you're LSU. But I mean, the fact that LSU doesn't have a third starter right now, like, I mean, there just aren't that many teams with third starters. Wake Forest has the best rotation in the country. Like, great. I feel good about them and their starting situation. But I don't know who else actually has a third starter around the country that you can feel good about. You know, like, you look at Vanderbilt and suddenly they have a lot of questions. You know, that rotation at times looked like the best rotation in the country. You know, but Carter Holton is certainly dealing with something right now. It just looks different if they don't have him in the rotation. You know, Arkansas has dealt with all kinds of injuries all season long, and, you know, their rotation is not like firmly set 1-2-3. Duke doesn't even have like more than one starter. Like, Duke is a complete whole staff every time out. Stanford, you know, we've talked about it. They've got like six pitchers that they can trust. And, you know, I don't think their situation looks all that different from LSU's. And, you know, Coastal is not that kind of team. South Carolina is dealing with their injuries. Like Florida, we've talked about it with Jack Caglione. He can't make it past like four innings, basically, as a starter. On and on and on. Like, there just aren't teams with pitching this year. Like, this is not where college baseball is this year. So I think that LSU's problems are getting magnified right now, but that's not to say that it's going to be this way all season long. And, you know, I just think that we're in for a different kind of tournament than what we've seen so many times in the past. This is not going to be a year that you get to Omaha and can't score, that you get a lead and like, it's, you know, there are going to be comebacks. For a long time at what used to be known as TD Ameritrade Park, like, it was like, you get a lead and you stay in the lead. There were no comebacks ever. That's not the way it is anymore. Charles Schwab Field, like everything else in college baseball, is playing more offensive. And I, you know, does LSU stack up against Wake Forest on the mound? No, they don't. But they stack up against anyone else, basically, I feel like, in terms of pitching. They've got the best pitcher in the country. They've got the best lineup in the country. Like, I feel fine if I'm LSU. You know, if you end up in a three-game series in the championship against Wake Forest and Wake Forest has their pitching lined up, like, we can talk about whether, like, that would be, you know, who would have the edge there. But aside from that scenario, I think LSU is just fine.
And that's a great point you make about the third starter, because I think it's really easy as a fan of LSU, as a fan of college baseball after this weekend, to have LSU's problems be magnified and say, oh man, they don't have any pitching. You know, we can beat them. They're not as good as we thought they were. When looking around the country, I don't think that there's a clubhouse in America where it's of the mentality of, oh man, we got to bury these guys on Saturday because on Sunday they have insert pitcher name, other than, like you said, Josh Hartle. And LSU has serious arm talent. While on Sunday it was a pretty rough showing, as I said, Christian Little is a really good arm. He's shown how good he can be. Griffin Herring has been excellent in at times out of the bullpen. Everyone just had a down day, which, again, in baseball, it's going to happen, and Auburn took advantage of it. Not to discredit anything Auburn did, because it was exceptional with how they played over the weekend. But as you said, it's LSU, because of the hand they were dealt with, the injuries, they're still kind of figuring out where all of these guys plug in, especially with Thatcher Hurd not being up to snuff out of the rotation. You kind of are figuring out where he fits best. And it looks to be in a back end role where, even just listening to him talk about it, he seems really confident in that role. And it's clear he's got the support of his teammates with the glowing reports that Paul Skeens has given him. But they're still in the unique camp of shuffling guys around a little bit and seeing who fits best where, because of the injuries that they're dealing with. So again, they have the arm talent. I have no doubt Coach Johnson is a great coach, and I have no doubt that he's going to figure it out and get it shored up as best he can as they head into the postseason. So yes, while the LSU doesn't have the pitching depth as some staffs do in the country, it is by no stretch of the imagination, I would say, you know, a real, I guess, mark against them.
Do not have time to get into every one of these SEC series, but I do want to look ahead to another big week, and we can talk a little bit about, you know, how some of these series ended up being what they are now. But this weekend, we've got South Carolina visiting Arkansas. South Carolina has now lost back-to-back series. They lost on Tuesday, to North Florida. South Carolina's reeling a little bit. On the other hand, they're getting a little healthier. Will McGillis made an appearance as a pinch runner. He'd been out for like more than a month. Talmadge LaCroix was back in the lineup. So that's a positive step for South Carolina, even as the on-field results have taken a step back. Vanderbilt's going to Florida this weekend. I don't want to say the SEC East is on the line, but it kind of is, because if Florida doesn't win this weekend, it's hard to see anybody catching Vanderbilt. And then Kentucky is at Tennessee. Important series. I feel like the ship might have sailed a little bit for Tennessee in terms of the hosting race at this point, having lost to Georgia. On the other hand, maybe it hasn't. And if they are able to get something done this weekend at home against Kentucky, and again, Tennessee plays incredibly well at Lindsey Nelson, it's a hard spot, you know, maybe they'll get back into it. So some intriguing series this weekend, some big opportunities, but more than opportunities, you know, you can look at this and say, how's it going to affect the top eight race, hosting race, whatever. Like, I just think these are three great series to watch.
Yeah, outside of the implications it has on the postseason, it's going to be quality baseball bound in the SEC, which in the SEC, it's really just another weekend. I think that it's hard to pick one that I'm most intrigued by, because each of these three series is very, very interesting for a number of reasons. But I think I'm most looking forward to, it's hard to not look forward to Vanderbilt, Florida, and seeing how those two teams will bounce back. But in terms of the added implications for postseason purposes, I think South Carolina, Arkansas piques my interest the most, mostly for how South Carolina is going to hopefully try and right this ship as they head into the last week of SEC play, because they got swept against Kentucky pretty handily. They dropped a midweek game against North Florida last night. Normally midweek games, it's a really weird time of the week and time of the year where a lot of these schools are going to refrain from using their top tier talent. So it's hard to judge a team on a midweek game, but again, it's starting to snowball a little bit on South Carolina. But as you mentioned, they're finally starting to get healthy again. Coach Kingston said that there's a non-zero chance or Braylon Wimmer could play this weekend, which I don't know if it would be Braylon Wimmer at 100%, but it would still be Braylon Wimmer, which would be a huge boost to that lineup. And I think that going on the road to Baum Walker, it's a really difficult task. And if South Carolina is able to win that series on the road, it's, you can kind of breathe a little bit as Gamecock fans. But if they lose, which is again a real possibility, I think at this point you've got to, as crazy as it sounds, are they headed towards a territory where they may not get a top 16 seed and host? I think
it is plausible. They're sitting at 13 and or 14 and 9 in the SEC. Their RPI is 4. I'd like to think that just two more SEC wins gets this done, but on the other hand, things are stacked up real tight in the East. South Carolina doesn't have an easy finish. It's hard to win any games at Baum Walker. Arkansas is like 25-3 at home or something. 28-3, excuse me. South Carolina can't really mess around too much now. Like, that sweep against Kentucky was not great. I still have them as a top 8 seed. The series sweep of Florida is doing a lot of work for them right now. But if Florida wins this weekend against Vanderbilt, South Carolina has a bad week, like, that flips it. And, you know, you don't want to, the other thing is just straight up, you don't want, they have a lot of negative momentum right now. You don't want that going into the tournament. And it's a hard place to turn it around in Fayetteville, but that's the task at hand this weekend for the Gamecocks.
Yeah. And you mentioned the negative momentum in looking at their season as a snapshot. If you went to any South Carolina fan heading into opening weekend and said, hey, I've got great news, on May 10th, which is when we're recording this, and heading into your second to last series, you're going to be 36-12. You're going to be 14-9 in the SEC. And your RPI is going to be in the top 10. I think that I know that every single fan would be blown away by that.
They're all signing up for that. Absolutely.
100%. But a little bit of recency bias here. You look at the two series losses in a row to teams that after that Florida sweep, you certainly didn't foresee them losing to. They've come back down to earth a little bit, and now you've got they're tasked with righting the ship against two tough opponents. And granted, they could absolutely do it. I'm confident that they win one of these series. I have that series with Tennessee at Founders Park circled as a potential statement one as they head into Hoover. But they really cannot afford they really can't afford another sweep this weekend at Baum Walker, even if they're able to take one game, and they very well could take two. But if they can avoid another sweep at Baum Walker and get a midweek win against Charlotte heading into their final series with Tennessee, I think they do what it takes to end up hosting and they get their guys back and healthy for Hoover in the postseason, and then they can kind of really get back to rolling. But I wouldn't say desperate times in Columbia, but this is a big series for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the things I typically say about, like, well, these are the benchmarks you need to host, you know, in the SEC, that means having a winning record, like an RPI that ranks in the top like 15 or so, certainly within the top 20. Some of those are kind of broken this year, I feel like. You know, when you look at RPI and you see that SEC teams are five of the top six spots, and, you know, you just keep going on down, and like it just continues to be dominated by SEC teams, you know that they're not all going to host. Like, it doesn't work like that typically. And maybe this year the committee will just say, screw it, like they all host. Like, they all have the RPIs, they all have the SEC wins they need, whatever. Like, put them all into hosts. Maybe it works like that. But also, maybe somebody gets squeezed out, and the same thing can be said for the top eight seeds. You know, when you try and, like, the SEC East standings may come into real play here, you know, and so South Carolina has that sweep of Florida, but they also got swept by Kentucky. And then that Tennessee series could end up being very meaningful, depending on how this week goes. So important for South Carolina to get back on track. Another big opportunity at home this weekend for Florida. They're coming off of a tough series loss at A&M. Vanderbilt coming off of a tough series loss at Alabama. Vanderbilt does not play as well on the road as they do at home. Surprise, surprise, almost every team, certainly in college baseball, can say that. But this is a big one for Florida. Like I said, if they want into the SEC East race, they need this one. And, you know, it has big implications for them for a top eight seed, which I have them right on the outside of right now, in part because their RPI is the worst of the SEC contenders for the top eight. This is an opportunity to turn that around, and just presents an intriguing matchup. You've got Jack Haglione against all of those Vanderbilt lefties. What's that going to look like? And, you know, he's coming off of setting the program record in home runs. And now he gets to deal with the likes of Hunter Owen and Devin Fittrell, and we'll see if Carter Holton is ready to go this weekend as well. But tough matchup for him in terms of those lefties that Vanderbilt's going to throw at him.
And we'll see on Holton. The update that I saw on Twitter wasn't the most encouraging, and he didn't travel to Louisville for the midweek game, which is
uncommon. Yes, he's a starting pitcher, but it's uncommon that he would not have been there.
I was going to say that shouldn't be too big of a red flag for anyone out there wondering. He was probably just back in Nashville doing whatever it is he needed to do. So really not all that indicative of whether or not he's going to throw this weekend. If he does, even as inconsistent as he has been recently, that's still a huge piece that you want throwing, especially against a premier Florida lineup. You want all the help you can get. And again, going on the road is very difficult. So it's just going to be a really, really fun matchup with a lot of high quality players in either dugout. And I'm most kind of curious to see the Florida pitching staff, namely Hurston Waldrop, how he throws. I think pitch usage has really killed him this year. Throws a lot of fastballs. It's not so much how many fastballs he throws, it's when he throws his fastball. So there are a lot of kind of games within the game, so to speak. But again, just if you can, this is definitely a series to watch just for the sheer talent in either dugout and for the implications it has. Because as you mentioned, Florida, to get that top eight national seed, they really need a series win like this to A, boost their RPI, and B, also boost their resume.
Alrighty, let's head out west. The big one last weekend was Stanford visiting Arizona State in a showdown for first place in the Pac-12. Stanford made a pretty big statement coming away with a series sweep in Phoenix, where Arizona State has played so well this season. Stanford now takes a relatively commanding lead. That might be a little too strong, but they're in a very good position in first place, especially because Oregon, who we discussed last week as maybe being a dark horse in the Pac-12 race, they took a series loss at USC. So Stanford now build up a nice little lead in the Pac-12 standings. They did it. It was not easy. At Arizona State, it was never going to be. The first two games were very back and forth, and Stanford found a way to win them both. And then on Sunday, they just kind of took care of business a little bit more. But a very compelling series, a lot of offense as expected, but Stanford ultimately able to get the big road series win. They're closing in on back-to-back Pac-12 titles, which is, it's not easy to do out there in any conference, really, to win back-to-back titles. But Stanford now holding a 3.5 game lead going into the final two weekends feel pretty good about the Cardinal and where they're at right now.
As you mentioned, it's not necessarily a super commanding lead. It's not the lead that Wake Forest has in the ACC Atlantic. But I would say the Pac-12 at this point in the regular season is Stanford's to lose in looking at the standings and who they have left. But this past weekend was what we expected and also not what we expected. I don't think that either of us expected a team to come out of Tempe with a sweep. I had fully expected Arizona to salvage a game on Sunday, or if Arizona State were to win the series, would not have been in a sweep. But Stanford did, I think, what the key to the series was, which was, you know, they got just enough pitching out of their pitching staff, which had been, for as odd as it is to say about a Stanford team where their pitching staff is usually its strength, the pitching staff did step up. Quinn Matthews was, I would say, as good as he could have been in a really hitter-friendly environment against a good lineup on Friday with 8 innings and 11 Ks. And then on Sunday, to polish off their sweep, Joey Dixon with the start and Brant Panzer to close it out and Max Meyer in the middle, they all threw really well, especially Panzer to close it out and seal the sweep with 2 2/3 in which he did not allow a run. And the Stanford offense, as we expected, was relentless. You had Tommy Troy, who homered in all three games. Carter Graham has really picked it up as of late, which that is a big-time revelation in Palo Alto because he was so productive last year with his 22 home runs and being that anchor on the right side of the infield. He got off to a really, really slow start this year that he is still kind of crawling out of, even with these great performances. And then again, they just got production from everywhere. Alberto Rios, the veteran, was really strong. And sophomore Jake Sapien, even though he hasn't really logged a ton of ABs, he's been really good as well. So a really impressive win for the Cardinal. On the flip side, I think that we kind of know at this point what Arizona State is. It's an offensive first team, and their offense is really good. With the personnel that they have, I mean, it is very, very good. 1 through 6, their lineup, I would say, even really 1 through 9, there isn't an easy out in there. But the pitching that they have, or lack thereof, I think severely limits their ceiling. Hosting is all but out of the picture for them. And I think in any regional setting and in a tournament setting, it's going to be really tough to kind of, I think, sustain a run and hit yourself deep into the tournament in Omaha with just the lack of personnel I think they have. And that's partially due to injuries. A lot of teams have unfortunately been bitten by the injury bug, but I think at this point we know who the Sun Devils are.
Yeah, they're 5-13 against teams in the top 50 of RPI. They have an ERA of 6.09, which ranks 10th in the Pac-12. They've lost 6 of their last 7, although maybe they won in midweek last week or yesterday. Coming out of the weekend, it was 6 of their last 7 games were losses. They're going to go on the road. They don't play as well on the road as they do at home, again, like every team in college baseball, basically. And it's going to be hard to see them coming out of it. Now, I have, you know, like we were saying with South Carolina, like you would sign up for what South Carolina's record is. Like, fans would have signed up for that at the start of the year, knowing where they are today. I think Arizona State fans probably would have as well for where they are. Expectations were a little, it was hard to pin down what this ASU team was going to be coming into this year because there was so much new, given how many guys they went into the portal to get. This still isn't where ASU wants to be. but they're in a better spot in year two under Willie Bloomquist. Now they have to solve this pitching situation going forward, which has been a bit of bugaboo for ASU for several years now. But it's an exciting offense. They look like they're headed back to the tournament. Like, they at least had this really exciting first place showdown in May. For a program like ASU, I don't want to like sit here and be like, and that's great, because I know the expectations are higher, but it is it's a process. And so I think that, I don't want to put a label on the season in May 10, but it does seem to be trending more towards successful season than unsuccessful. Elsewhere in the Pac-12, like I said, USC won a series against Oregon. That was pretty significant for USC. I still have them as bubble out. Their RPI is still problematic, but it was a big one, big response for them. They play exceptionally well at home, and they now get Arizona State at home this weekend in a significant series for both of those teams. And then Oregon is back home against Washington again. Should be a really compelling series. And then, Peter, the other one that I want to mention is that UCLA is in free fall right now. They got swept by Cal, which came into the weekend in last place in the Pac-12. UCLA is now 10-12-1, something like that, in the Pac-12. They're under 500. And their RPI is north of 60 right now. Like, the Bruins really look like they're going to miss the NCAA tournament, which is not where I thought they would be. Injuries, as you said, have been bad around college baseball a lot. UCLA has been hit as hard as anyone, it feels like, and it shows. And it's just really unfortunate to see their season derailed like this. Kudos to Cal for going out and getting that series sweep on the road, but that was a bad, bad weekend for UCLA.
Yeah, and not to discredit anything Cal did, because a series sweep over UCLA is still a series sweep over UCLA. As you mentioned, UCLA is just 2-6 in their last 8 games. They've really struggled in Pac-12 play. They've lost their last 3 Pac-12 series. They've lost, I think, 4 or 5, maybe even 5 of 6, but they just have not been 100% healthy, it feels like, all season. And because when one piece has returned, they got Kyle Karros back from injury, but then Cody Schreier, their star shortstop, went down with a shoulder issue. And then when Karros is back and he's getting his feet under him, then Malachi Knight, who's been really good, goes down with an injury. And then on the pitching staff, I mean, which has been their strength to its credit, the ERA of 4.25 is actually pretty solid given the nature of college baseball this year. But you kind of look to their rotation as a bright spot with, okay, we've got Jake Brooks, Kelly Austin, and Alonzo Treadwell. That at the very least is going to keep us in ball games weekend and every weekend. And then you add in some bullpen pieces with Charles Harrison and Cody Delvecchio. But again, they get some really rough news last week where it looks like Alonzo Treadwell is now going to be out for the year. And given the current state of the Bruins with both their RPI and their overall resume, they have 2 tough series remaining with Oregon State and Arizona State. It is going to be really, really, it's an uphill battle for them for the first time in what feels like a really long time to make a regional. And it feels like they're going to have to win probably both of these series and have a strong Pac-12 tournament to kind of back themselves into a regional berth. And even if they were to make a regional, I just don't know. It just comes down to having enough bodies, and I just don't know, how much they have and where you can point to as, okay, UCLA might not have a great lineup, but at least they've got a great pitching staff, which they still do, I think, as a whole, but they're missing, I think, that their best arm for the rest of the year. So I guess in looking for a bright spot, like, Deuce Gorson has been solid all year, and their pitching staff, as I've mentioned, has been really strong, even with the injuries they've dealt with. But man, it is desperation time in Westwood, and they've got to pull a rabbit out of their hat really fast.
Oregon also, like I said, they took it on the chin at USC with a series loss, and I think their hosting hopes are dead, essentially. Like, they're never dead. You play in the Pac-12, you you know, reel off a couple big weekends and, you know, you got a shot. But going 1-3 last week again against Oregon State and USC all on the road was a real detriment. Their RPI has fallen out of the top 25. Stanford's the only Pac-12 team with a top 25 RPI. Everyone knows that RPI doesn't love the West Coast, and the committee is aware of it and usually gives them some leeway, but Oregon's going to need a strong finish. The good news is they're going back home for the series against Washington, and then they get Utah on the road, and Utah's now in last place. So, you know, you got a favorable schedule, I would say, for Oregon. Like, the series against Washington is going to be tough, and those are two programs that, you know, don't love each other, traditional rivalry, but at least you're back at home and then on the road against the last place team in the league. We'll see what Oregon can do from here, if they can get back to a spot where they're in contention to host. But right now that was a tough one at USC and USC with a big opportunity this weekend, with ASU coming to town, and USC continues 23-6 at home. It's remarkable. They're just 5-13-1 on the road. But they're remarkable at home. So, you know, a tough road for them as well with ASU, and then at Arizona. Arizona's playing a lot better. And again, USC just doesn't play well on the road. But if they have two solid weekends here, they're not out of it yet. So, I remain intrigued by the Trojans at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially with how well they play at Dado Field, and you get kind of an Arizona State team right where you want them, and they're not necessarily USC, they're not necessarily the most offensive club, and it feels like a weekend where their offense could break through with the arms that they're going to see, but and how well they play at Dado Field. Again, probably on the outside looking in, maybe one of the last couple of teams in the tournament field right now. But if they're able to notch another series win over Arizona State, that certainly puts them on the right side of the bubble, and then that they kind of head into a favorable end of the season matchup with Arizona. So a very interesting matchup for the Trojans out west, and then with Washington and Oregon, as you mentioned, a little bit of a rivalry series there. Washington, after a series loss against Stanford, has started to play really well again with series sweep over USC, a series win over arch rival Washington State. So a big series for the Huskies and their tournament aspirations as well. They really want a series win, I think, that they can hang their hat on. They're kind of the UCLA series win at the start of Pac-12 play looked like a really good one. Now it's not. Granted, that was a very different UCLA team, so that's a nuanced argument. But a series win at Oregon at PK Park would work wonders for their resume. I think that would be a series win they can hang their hat on. So another intriguing weekend out west that I think coming out of it, we could have a completely different picture of where teams stand, other than, you know, Stanford still being a potential top 8 national seed.
Yeah, and just quickly on UW, I think it's important that they just maintain their place in the standings. Right now they're fifth. They're a half game ahead of USC because they have a terrible non-conference strength of schedule. Like NC State, very, you know, got stunned last year when they got left out of the tournament, and their non-conference strength of schedule was part of the rationale. That was bad. NC State was like 180 or something in non-conference strength of schedule. Washington is like 100 spots worse than that almost. They're down there in like 260.
I think it's 75. I randomly saw it last night and it stuck out.
It's bad. And, you know, if that's not a piece that the committee is going to go out there looking to say like, oh, like disqualified because of this. But if it's tight, the committee just last year showed that they're very much paying attention to that. And Northeastern is down there in terms of at-large teams, but nobody else is. And so, you know, if you're looking for a reason to say no to somebody, like that's going to be there to say no to Washington. So I think it's important for Washington to just have a good, you know, just establish that they are clearly one of the Pac-12's better teams. This is a conference that's going to get 5, maybe 6 bids. And if you can just say like, hey, we're right there. We're fifth in the standings. We're fourth in the standings. I think the committee is going to say like, okay, fine. Like you're in, like you've proved yourself in Pac-12 play to be worthy. And they have that nice sweep of USC, and like, they have a lot of nice things going for them. But like, I keep looking at that every time I open Washington's page, and I look at that number and I'm like, ugh. I wouldn't, having watched what happened to NC State a year ago, having watched what happened to Rutgers a year ago, like, I would not want to be like, that's not something I want on my resume. And they can't do anything about it now. So they just have to win as many Pac-12 games as they can. And that starts this weekend in Eugene.
Right. And 29-14 overall, 13-10 in the Pac-12, a really good mark overall. But then when you start to kind of dig in a little deeper, as you said, the strength of the schedule is a big deterrent, I think. And then obviously with who they've played, just 1-2 against RPI top 25, and then 2-3 against RPI 26 through 50. So work to be done, a really crucial series win, I think, for them to try and get as the season closes out.
All right, let's go to the Big 12, a place that we haven't visited terribly recently, but has become one of the most fascinating races down the stretch. West Virginia's in first place. They're two games up. That's not really where the interest lies. West Virginia seems like they're the best team, but they've got big series this weekend against Texas Tech. What's intriguing here is kind of the rest of the standings. Everyone's pretty bunched up here. There's not a whole lot of teams that I would say are clearly, you know, determined their NCAA tournament fate. You also have another big series this weekend with K-State heading to Oklahoma State. And those are the two teams that are closest to West Virginia in the standings. They're two games back. Oklahoma State trying to push into the hosting race, trying to push into a hosting spot. They're in the race. K-State trying to, you know, say, yes, put us in the NCAA tournament. They're 31-18 overall. They have an RPI of 57. They have some nice series wins, but it's very bubbly right now. But if they can get another big series win here against Oklahoma State, that would be a big stamp in their favor. And, you know, like I just said with Washington, you know, and how the Pac-12 standings are really going to be important for that, I feel like the same is going to be true here for Kansas State. Unlike in these other conferences, you know, I can point to, you know, in the SEC, if you got 14 wins, you're almost certainly in. If you get to 15 wins in the ACC, you're in great shape. It's 16 in the Pac-12. There is no number in the Big 12. Part of that's because they only play 24 conference games, but things are just kind of all over the place within the Big 12. You know, you saw West Virginia get left out last year and not even really be in the bubble discussion, despite being 14-10 in the conference. But they were like fifth in the standings. That was part of the reason why they just weren't taken all that seriously. I feel like if K-State can get a nice record, can finish in a strong spot in the Big 12, like, I think some of their other flaws on the resume will be ignored. And this weekend's a major opportunity for them. Kansas State's proven they can compete with just about anyone in the Big 12, and they get another chance to do it. Unfortunately for them, it is on the road, but this is that series definitely has my attention. It's got some nice prospects in it. You got two really strong shortstops and Marcus Brown at Oklahoma State, and Nick Goodwin at K-State, and two teams that are playing really well right now. Oklahoma State has certainly been rolling. K-State, I did not anticipate coming into the year that K-State Oklahoma State would have my attention in the second to last weekend of the regular season, but here we are.
And in the Big 12, as we've mentioned all year, it's been such a weird conference, and no one had wanted to separate themselves from the pack up until West Virginia recently, who, as you mentioned, I think it's pretty clear that they're the top dogs in the conference. Again, though, they have another big series this weekend when they welcome Texas Tech to Morgantown. But no, as you mentioned, the Oklahoma State and Kansas State series, at least to this point, and probably for the whole season, I think this is the biggest Big 12 series that we're going to get. And as you mentioned, Kansas State is playing really well as of late. Oklahoma State has been pretty strong all season. They've had their ebbs and flows as any ball club, but for the most part, they've been really good thanks to their extreme offensive production, which I think, in alluding to that, I'd be remiss not to mention that this series is at Obrate Stadium, where if you describe a stadium as a launch pad or an airport, whatever it is that you want to use to describe how the ball flies there, you're going to need a whole new adjective for Obrate Stadium, because if you see a ball off the bat and it looks like, okay, that's going to be a fly out to left or a fly out to right or anywhere in the outfield, it's probably going to get over the fence. And we saw it all last weekend with Oklahoma State. We've seen it all season. And they're a super, super offensive club. Kansas State, not quite as offensive. I don't think any team in the conference is as offensive as Oklahoma State, but it is a really good series. As you mentioned, there are prospects abound with Nick Goodwin, Marcus Brown, and then looking forward, you know, and obviously Rock Riggio, but even looking forward, you have some of the top 2024s and 2025s that are going to be eligible with Carson Benj for Oklahoma State, Nolan Schubart for Oklahoma State, and then looking in the other dugout, you've got Kalen Culpepper, who is a super physical third baseman, can really impact the ball. And then out of the bullpen, they've got Tyson Nabors, who is quickly establishing himself as one of the best relief pitchers in the country. So it is going to be a fascinating series. It's difficult to not give the edge to Oklahoma State with the home field advantage they have. Yes, Kansas State has a great bullpen arm, a few great bullpen arms, but they've got a great stopgap with Tyson Nabors. But you got to get him the ball. So it's all about if Kansas State can keep pace with the Oklahoma State offense, which is easier said than done. But I do think that they have the edge on the pitching side of things. So it's kind of strength on strength. And I'd love for it selfishly just to come down to a decisive third game, because I think that would be a lot of fun for a whole lot of reasons. But we'll see how it plays out. I'm really excited to tune in.
Absolutely. And we mentioned the Texas Tech West Virginia series. Texas Tech with an absolutely wild game on Tuesday. It was the resumption of a suspended game against Abilene Christian, and they had gone down big before the rain came a week ago. They flipped that game. They won it. Maybe they'll be able to take some momentum from that into Morgantown. West Virginia's really only stumbled against Kansas this season, and that was in Morgantown. So they're gettable to an extent, but Texas Tech certainly plays better at home. We've been over that a million times. They're closer to the bubble than maybe you would anticipate. Certainly, you know, you look at our poll, and you know, we feel still pretty good about Texas Tech, having them ranked in the teens. But RPI does not agree. They're 52. They're 500 in the conference. They have mixed in some really good wins with some bad losses, and that's how the RPI has gotten where it's gotten. Their schedule strength is mediocre, I guess, and they haven't played terribly well away from home. 6-10 on the away from Lubbock. So they're trying to reverse some of that. They get Kansas in a week, but I'll tell you, if they could get something done in Morgantown, that would be majorly beneficial to the Red Raiders.
Yeah, and it, as you said, West Virginia has the clear advantage. They're playing really well. It seems like they have all their ducks in a row from a personnel standpoint. And in the rotation, that 1-2 punch of Blaine Traxel and Ben Hampton is a pretty darn good one. You get Traxel, who is a absolute workhorse, throws from a funky arm slot and avoids hard contact. And then you get kind of a soft tossing lefty with Ben Hampton. That provides two really unique looks for opposing hitters, and one that's going to keep them kind of guessing and off balance. And and on offense, they have one of the best offensive players who, in my mind, isn't getting enough, I think, national recognition for what he's doing with J.J. Weatherholt. He's actually overtaken Dylan Cruz for the top batting average in the country after it's a nitpick. Cruz went 0-for-2 last night with like three walks, but he's technically overtaken Dylan Cruz for the top batting average in the country, hitting .463 with 18 doubles and 13 home runs. He's also stolen 32 bases. He's a big-time difference maker, both with his bat and on the base paths. So he's one of the more exciting players to watch in college baseball. As you mentioned, Texas Tech, outside of home, they've struggled as a team, but so, you know, who hasn't? And they're a super offensive club. Part of that, you know, might be a little bit due to where they play with their power numbers being inflated, but they've still got a number of good hitters with Kevin Bazell, Gavin Cash, and Nolan Hester leading the way. So, well, I think runs won't necessarily be at a premium. I think it'll be tougher for them to score against a really strong West Virginia pitching staff. And you mentioned it as well. Their resume, we may have them, you know, ranked high, but I wouldn't get clouded in that. But because their resume, they still have they still have some to be desired, and a series win against a top 12 West Virginia team would really enable them to kind of breathe a little bit as they head down the stretch.
The other series to watch this weekend is in Conference USA. It's a battle for first place. Dallas Baptist heads to San Antonio to take on UTSA and the Roadrunners. Both of these teams could use this one, obviously, just from a standings perspective, but also from a resume perspective. DBU taking a couple tough losses over the last couple weeks, and you know their RPI is taking a hit. UTSA's RPI keeps slipping as well, and you know, I feel like they probably should be reasonably safely in the tournament, but also maybe not. So we'll see. But this weekend, you know, first place on the line in Conference USA. And that, just setting aside all of the NCAA tournament you know, resume stuff, if we can do that. But just it's a showdown. This is UTSA's last season in Conference USA before they move to the American. This is DBU's first season in Conference USA. So a lot of intrigue on this one. I really respect what Patrick Hallmark's been able to do with the Roadrunners since he took that program over. This would be a big statement if they are able to win this series, go on and win the conference. That would be a really nice accomplishment for them. And meanwhile, DBU just continues being as consistent as ever. And their pitching staff has been great, and they've gotten healthier offensively. And I think that's been important for them. Getting Nate Humphreys back over the last couple of weeks has been big for that team. So we'll certainly have an eye on that one as well.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, a huge series. I think that whoever wins this one is going to have a stranglehold on the regular season CUSA standings. Would be a great note for Coach Hallmark to end his CUSA tenure on. Would be a great note for DBU to start their CUSA tenure on. And as you mentioned, big in for the tournament resumes for different reasons. I think DBU is pretty safely in, but when you look at UTSA, the RPI north of 50, they would like a marquee series win like this to kind of shore up their resume as we kind of propel ourselves towards Selection Monday. So going to be a really fun one in Dallas.
Alrighty, that's a lot that we covered. It was a big week around the sport. Hopefully we can have another one, but just a little more on the field in terms of a big week for college baseball in the week ahead. A lot of really interesting series, a lot of fun matchups here this time of year, and a lot of great baseball to be watched this weekend. So we'll have plenty to say next week on the Baseball America College podcast. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, hit the subscribe or follow button. We really appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. All of the written content is over at baseballamerica.com. And there's a lot to keep you busy this time of year, both with college baseball and on the pro side and the draft side. If you're into that as well, make sure to check it out over at baseballamerica.com. For Peter, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.